Welcome to The Debate. Today we're diving into different perspectives on the federal news update for Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. Now, this was a really pivotal 48-hour period back in late September 2025, wasn't it? Defined by, well, this unprecedented tension in Washington. You had a very swift, very assertive executive branch pushing major policy directives.
Right. And on the other side, a legislative branch almost completely paralyzed, really, by the threat of a looming government shutdown.
Exactly. So the central question that springs from this strategic misalignment seems pretty clear. Does the executive branch's aggressive, almost unilateral use of power during these 2 days represent, you know, necessary strategic leadership cutting through legislative failure and, frankly, gridlock?
Or is it actually a dangerous structural expansion of executive authority, one that, you know, fundamentally undermines the separation of powers that we rely on?
Well, my contention is that these actions were decisive, focused, and absolutely necessary to achieve longstanding policy goals precisely because Congress had failed in its core duties.
See, I come at it from a rather different angle. Well, look, I recognize that gridlock is incredibly frustrating for everyone. I'd argue that this rapid accumulation of unilateral power is fundamentally eroding our constitutional checks and balances. The administration, it seems to me, is weaponizing the crisis of a potential shutdown purely for ideological gain. Achieving speed, yes, but at the profound expense of constitutional stability.
But this specific 48-hour window was, I mean, you can't deny it, it was a demonstration of strategic governance, especially when faced with legislative impotence. While Congress was busy proving itself incapable of passing a budget, which is, let's face it, its most basic constitutional duty, the executive leveraged its authority. It drove a transformative agenda on multiple fronts. Just look at the foreign policy landscape for a moment. We saw truly decisive leadership there with the unveiling of that high-stakes 20-point Gaza peace plan. And the speed wasn't just the key thing. The insight was the administration's ability to quickly forge this unified international coalition. It brought together Israel, key Arab states, Islamic states. And securing that explicit public apology from Prime Minister Netanyahu to Qatar, that was a massive, unprecedented diplomatic lever. It forced regional consensus, allowed the deal to move forward rapidly, and it effectively bypassed those traditional, slow-moving diplomatic channels where, you know, congressional influence often just dilutes the outcome.
Okay, that's arguably a powerful case for necessary speed in foreign policy, I might grant you that. But it's the domestic maneuvers, the things happening here at home, that truly concern me. The administration didn't just move fast. They seemed to move to fundamentally change the rules of the game, specifically using the threat of the shutdown.
But the OMB directive was critical domestically. The instruction to prepare for permanent reductions in force, RIFs, you know, for programs not consistent with the president's priorities. This is not, as you suggest, an erosion of power. I see it as a necessary targeted efficiency measure.
When Congress simply refuses to defund programs the public has effectively voted against, doesn't the executive have a duty to correct the size and scope of an administrative state that's just bloated by years of inaction?
And furthermore, the judiciary even seemed to back this proactive stance. The Supreme Court effectively ratified this power by allowing the administration to impound that $4 billion in congressionally appropriated foreign aid. That confirmed, didn't it, that the executive must have flexibility in executing policy, even if it contradicts the specific intent of a congressional appropriation?
I see why you rely on that court ruling, but the context of these actions taken together demonstrates what I'd call an unprecedented and frankly dangerous exploitation of crisis purely for ideological restructuring. Let's be absolutely clear here. The administration appears to be actively weaponizing the government shutdown. They are moving far beyond the historic precedent of, you know, temporary furloughs to unilaterally dismantle federal agencies through mass RIFs. This completely bypasses the legislative process that should be required for administrative reform. And it politicizes the civil service using these highly subjective criteria. I mean, what is consistent with the president's priorities truly mean in practice?
Okay, but for listeners who might not track the minutiae of civil service rules day to day, can you just break down why this RIF threat is fundamentally different and, as you say, more dangerous than the standard shutdown furlough that, you know, we've seen in the past?
Yeah, and that really is the core distinction, and it's essential to grasp. Traditionally, a lapse in appropriations leads to a furlough. Federal employees are placed on a temporary non-duty, non-pay status. And historically, Congress has always made sure they receive back pay when the government reopens. The job itself remains.
Right.
The RIF directive, however, transforms this budget crisis into a mechanism for permanent layoffs. It becomes a tool for administrative reform or perhaps restructuring that absolutely should require congressional action, debate, legislation. By turning the potential shutdown into a mechanism for what feels like a political purge of disfavored programs, the administration gains this sort of existential leverage over Congress that wasn't really utilized before in this way. It fundamentally undermines the integrity, the neutrality of the civil service.
I really have to push back on that framing of political purge. I think that interpretation overlooks the stark reality that Congress is perpetually deadlocked on these things. If a program is genuinely wasteful or inefficient, programs that consistently fail to deliver on their stated mandate, why must the executive be forced to mandate that those positions be saved indefinitely? This isn't about dismantling government. It's about streamlining it, aligning it with the mandate of the elected government. If Congress fails to enforce responsible spending, the executive has, I believe, a strategic obligation to leverage that lapse in appropriations to achieve administrative alignment. And let's be clear, OPM guidance does allow for rifts during a shutdown. This administration is simply utilizing that existing authority, perhaps more assertively, but responsibly.
But surely the authority exists for specific, targeted agency needs, perhaps restructuring within an agency, not as a blanket government-wide strategy explicitly tied to subjective political priorities. That shifts the entire negotiating dynamic, doesn't it? It transforms a temporary lapse, an inconvenience, into potentially an act of institutional vandalism directed against programs the political opposition happens to favor.
Well, if the domestic administrative speed, this ability to unilaterally realign the internal bureaucracy, worries you, what about the economic dimension? How does the swift action on immigration, specifically that $100,000 H-1B fee, how does that play into this constitutional question for you?
It just reveals the same pattern, doesn't it? Speed and unilateral action overriding legislative prudence and, I'd argue, constitutional balance. The executive is essentially using fees to functionally legislate, setting major policy without Congress.
Exactly. And I'd argue the H-1B fee imposition and the creation of the $1 million gold card residency program alongside it are decisive economic actions. They're designed to protect American workers and, yes, monetize access for foreign capital. The substantial fee is there to curb the alleged abuse of the H-1B system, which, let's be honest, has often been used to undercut domestic wages. It ensures that companies wanting global talent must pay a significant premium, which directly benefits the U.S. Treasury. This bifurcated high-cost system clearly signals an America-first posture, favoring capital contribution, perhaps over just skills or waiting for legislative consensus.
That's certainly a compelling argument if your main priority is financial input. But I find that framing deeply, deeply troubling. This isn't protecting the workforce. It's imposing what amounts to a crippling innovation tax. Okay, maybe large established tech firms can absorb a $100,000 fee per worker. Maybe. But smaller startups, research institutions, universities, they simply cannot afford that kind of money. This fundamentally forces them out of the global talent pool. We're already hearing prominent investors warning this strategy will accelerate a severe brain drain, pushing critical R&D operations overseas to countries that are more welcoming. And furthermore, this whole gold card pivot, essentially monetizing residency for $1 million, it fundamentally redefines American immigration values. It shifts towards valuing capital above skilled contribution or, frankly, any humanitarian considerations.
Well, I'm not entirely convinced by the innovation tax argument because it seems to ignore the systemic wage depression that the prior H-1B system clearly created, or at least contributed to. The executive order is intended, as I see it, to force companies to invest in American workers first. And yes, legal challenges are inevitable. We know the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already signaled a lawsuit, but the necessity of reforming a broken system, that remains paramount.
And we see similar decisive action, perhaps even more concerning, on the domestic security front, where the executive asserted authority far beyond recent precedent during this period. And that is arguably the most profoundly dangerous expansion of executive power we saw during this 48-hour window. The formal designation of Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, coupled with NSPM 7, that's a National Security Presidential Memorandum, directing the Treasury Department and the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, the JTTFs, to investigate the institutional and individual funders of these movements. This dangerously redirects vast counterterrorism resources inward.
But when you face organized violence...
But when you use the full apparatus of the JTTFs and sophisticated financial surveillance tools, tools which were built and legislated primarily for external threats like Al-Qaeda, and you turn them against domestic ideological movements, especially one as decentralized and frankly ill-defined as Antifa, it sets an incredibly chilling and dangerous precedent. This vague designation provides the bureaucratic pretext, doesn't it, to suppress legitimate political speech and financial activity associated with left-wing dissent. It feels like an unprecedented violation of established First Amendment norms.
You characterize it as suppressing dissent, but you seem to be ignoring the core threat the executive order explicitly addresses, a militarist, anarchist enterprise that explicitly calls for the overthrow of the United States government. Surely we must use all available authorities to investigate, disrupt, and dismantle networks that sponsor organized political violence, utilizing financial intelligence tools against those funding movements engaged in actual violence seems like a rational and necessary application of domestic security authority.
But the link is often tenuous.
And look at the context. The administration is simultaneously ordering federal troops into cities like Portland to quell anti-ICE protests where local law enforcement has been deemed ineffective or unwilling. When violence and anarchy become the currency of political opposition, the state must deploy every resource to maintain constitutional order. The target, as I understand it, is the organizational and financial infrastructure supporting violence, not peaceful protest itself.
I understand the imperative to maintain order, of course, but where does the executive draw the line when the designation itself is against a decentralized ideology? The legal authority to formally designate a domestic organization as a terrorist group simply doesn't exist statutorily in the same way it does for foreign groups. Yet the administration is operating as if it does, leveraging the financial surveillance powers of the Treasury Department in a way that, well, it creates regulatory reality without any clear legislative approval. This feels like fiat governance substituting for law, which fundamentally compromises our constitutional checks and balances.
But let me ask you this. If Congress is functionally incapable of passing a budget, incapable of reforming immigration, incapable of effectively responding to politically motivated domestic violence, isn't the failure of the separation of powers already sort of baked into the situation? Doesn't the executive then have a strategic obligation to fill that vacuum using the available legal tools and judicial precedents like that foreign aid impoundment ruling just to ensure that governance actually proceeds?
That's a very pragmatic perspective, I suppose. But my deep concern is that filling the vacuum with unilateral action ultimately destroys the very balance of power it claims to uphold. The Constitution anticipates conflict between the branches. It expects friction. It does not authorize the executive to effectively dismantle legislative or judicial checks merely because they are inconvenient or slow. The policies implemented in this intense 48-hour window, the RIF threats, the impoundment, the H-1B fee, the Antifa designation, they are all, in my view, examples of the executive asserting radical interpretations of its own authority specifically in response to congressional inaction. The solution to gridlock can't be constitutional erosion.
So, summarizing my view,
The events of September 29th and 30th demonstrate a period where the executive branch strategically, and I believe necessarily, moved beyond the paralysis of Congress. It achieved core policy objectives across foreign policy, administrative reform, and economic nationalism. The White House successfully utilized both internal crisis, the shutdown threat, and judicial endorsement, that foreign aid impoundment ruling, to implement a decisive, transformative agenda. Focused leadership, when legally grounded, proved, in this instance, to be an effective remedy for legislative failure.
And from my perspective, while the executive has certainly achieved speed and decisive action, the price paid is a profound constitutional instability. By threatening permanent layoffs based on political criteria, effectively impounding congressionally appropriated funds, and monetizing core aspects of immigration policy, the administration has asserted a truly radical interpretation of presidential power that seriously challenges the established limits of separation of powers. This period leaves a federal government operating in a state of, well, dissonance, forcing the judiciary increasingly to arbitrate these fundamental, almost existential questions about the scope and balance of government authority. It guarantees long-term constitutional battles ahead, no doubt about it.
We have certainly laid out contrasting interpretations of this pivotal 48-hour period. It's evident that the aggressive policy implementation we saw didn't merely overcome gridlock, but fundamentally challenged the checks and balances that underpin American governance.
Indeed. And there is clearly much more to explore in the ongoing implications of this dramatic realignment of power,